Case 52 from the Shoyoroku Sozan's Dharmakaya. Preface to the assembly. All knowledgeable persons are able to learn by parable and analogy. But when comparisons cannot be made, and when it's impossible to find something similar or identical, how can it be expressed? Main case, the koan. Attention! Sozan asked Tokujoza, Buddha's true Dharmakaya is like the vast sky. Its conforming to things and manifesting shapes is like the moon in the water. How can this principle of conforming be expressed? Toku said, it's like the donkey seeing the well. Sozan remarked, well said, but that's only 80% of it. Toku rejoined, how about you, Osho? Sozan replied, the well sees the donkey. Appreciatory verse. Donkey sees the well. Well sees the donkey. Wisdom contains, without exception. Purity permeates more than enough. Behind the elbow, who discerns the sign? Within the house, no books are kept. Loom threads don't hang, a matter of the shuttle. Patterns emerge every which way. The intent differentiates of itself. Third day of our session, of our training period, together, and we have launched the boat. We have set sail together. We are out in this wonderful, vast, unimpeded ocean, a wonderful ocean of self-nature. And we've been studying, looking into this koan from the Shoyoroku, the Book of Equanimity, of the donkey looking into the well, and we have a crew of donkeys on this boat, so we're all gazing into the, each one of us in our own donkey-like way, is gazing into our own heart and our own mind, looking intently within, and going through our many changes as we enter into this process and become more and more intimate with this process of bare attention or choiceless awareness, more and more intimate with all of these realms that we pass in and out of. And we are again and again quite sternly urged, encouraged to practice this wonderful practice of cutting the gap between ourselves and our experience, and doing it with an intention, as it says in the poem, doing it with the intention. And the intention is one of what we used to call, when I was an anthropologist, a participant observation, or observation by engagement or being one with it. And the great challenge for all of us, of course, is that as we get closer to ourselves, as we get closer to the aliveness of this moment, that we we black out, and then we go into the habit force. We're lost in the habit of it, and we are lost in it rather than upright in it. And that's such an important distinction. Upright in it, or a full participation, or aware as it in it, is the turning. The turning place in the bodhisattva practice and in koan study, or what we call the hairpin turn, or the turning over of consciousness. And it's turning over of consciousness because the teaching is it's turning over of consciousness because what was problem and what was a stumbling place, or what was seen as the difficulty becomes the resource. That's the nature of a koan study, the nature of all of these cases of little mind looking into big mind, or a self gazing upon itself, and sometimes we gaze upon ourselves and what we see is so familiar that we imagine that we know it. It's so familiar, seeing you, been there, done that 100 times, and there is a kind of, sometimes a kind of flatness or a kind of boredom that overtakes us, or a kind of assumption that we make that because we've been married to this guy, this woman, this being for such a long time that we, that they are totally boringly predictable. You again at the breakfast table with your newspaper. You again, you know, I know what you'll say when I do this, and I know exactly how you'll look at me, and I know exactly what you'll do, and we get our exercise jumping to conclusions and making assumptions that we know this being. I suppose in some ways we do, but the way that we know them is a rather superficial and guarded and defended way of knowing. And the price we pay for holding our opinion and our assumptions about the self or the activity of life or the Dharmakaya or the Nirmanakaya is that we seal ourselves off, and we become cynical and bored and jaded, and we feel cut off, and we feel disappointed and ill at ease. And we think, if only I would get away from this person, if only I could divorce myself from myself, I would be free. And he keeps following me around everywhere I go. I tried to leave him up in Kentucky at the monastery where I live, but the guy sneaked onto the plane with me, and then here I am out in the garden. I thought, well, I'll just go for a stroll out in the garden, in this beautiful garden with the flowers and butterflies everywhere, you know, this wonderful garden and butterflies, and he has the tendency to just hang around, you know, he just won't leave me. You gotta hand it to the guy, he's really devoted. And I think there's a certain wisdom in the devotion of it, that he just doesn't quit, you know, against all odds. He makes his comments and says, whispers, he's the backseat driver, no matter what, he's relentless, and makes his comments and says what he says, and against all odds, it's quite a remarkable thing. So the thing about Shikantaza practice, or this self-fulfilling samadhi that we're engaged in terms of self-gazing upon itself, self-looking into itself, or self becoming more intimate with the elusive obvious. all of the koan of the Shoyoroku, this book has more of the flavor of the school of quiet illumination, and more, a little bit more of the a different flavor, but same basic practices. Same basic practices, the curriculum of Momonkan and Hekigan Roku that we study. And basically, whether we frame it as koan introspection, case koan introspection, or shikantaza, the really important thing to keep in mind is that what is really important and what koan is about a truth or aliveness, or actually what it is that's happening now. That's the meaning of koan. Koan means truth happening. And of course, since it is a verb and not a fixed position, it is a movement or a happening. So we are encouraged in our Zen practice to slow down sufficiently to be able to encounter or to touch or to enter into what it is that's actually happening. No small matter. Easy to talk about the shikan, the slowing. She is to slow down or to settle self. Can settle within itself. And the con is the capacity we have when the mind is clear and the mind is still. Or the mind is innocent or undefended or guileless. In other words, we melt down our thought feeling mass, our opinion, our holdings, our habit. You know, we polish, we rub, we scorch, we grind, we dissolve, we do different times and places. There's the different kinds of letting go, isn't there? Or different kinds of dissolution, or different kinds of deconstruction. that happened, but we are determined to slow down sufficiently so that the mind can become still. And when the mind is still, it has a capacity to know and appreciate, which is immediate and innate and does not require thinking. So what we explore as practitioners, as yogis, as Zen students, is this this great inquiry or this great question: is there a way of knowing? Is there a meaning that might be found? Is there a beauty, a truth that could be found that is not dependent upon thought? A thought is, of course, thought has its own beauty, and thought is ultimately of the Dharmakaya body, nothing but the manifestation of the brightness. But of course, the attachment to thought, or the fixation on the mind road, or our leaving, you know, attaching to thought is, of course, the problem. So we inquire, and the inquiry is there a way of knowing that is more satisfying than thinking about our experience? Is there a way of being intimate? Is there a way of loving? Is there a way of appreciating this incredibly fragile, immensely beautiful raw thing that is living us, this life? And of course, all of us in this room, or we wouldn't be here, have had openings and have had glimpses of this non-dual world, this world of timeless, world of pure aliveness. And because we've smelled it, or we've glimpsed it, or we have hopefully we have marinated ourselves more completely in it, we even though we forget, and it disappears from our view in the relentlessness of our samsara, of our thinking, of our, you know, just scurrying about and losing sight of what it is we are, still we smell and we know it somewhere, and we have this longing and homesickness for what we saw. Because what we saw when we glimpse, or when we know, or when we resolve the when the shikantaza becomes clear, or we resolve the koan, in other words, when we cut the gap between what we're the experiencer and what we're experiencing, and the gap is always filled with thought and opinion and idea and assumption. No small matter, easy to say this, but it's so hypnotic, and it so inducts us, and it so draws us in, and it so tells us that there's nobody here but me, and there's nothing but the truth of what I'm telling you, this self that follows us around. We walk into the garden, and it whispers in my ear, it talks to me, and it actually puts me in, when I say me, it's not me as opposed to you, but this is the human condition. It is an envelope that that encases me, or an envelope that encases me, and it convinces me that this is truth, that life is disappointing, that you'll always be this way. There is no possibility for redemption or truth or beauty or true love in your life. You'll always be, don't dare. You might as well just go home, or just stay in the monastery and wait it out until you're 67. Shit, in a couple of years you'll be dead. And there are times when it seems quite plausible to me. Maybe that's a really great idea. I think I'll just fold it up, and you know, I'll tell them I've got the flu or something, and I'll go back to the monastery and just wait it out. You know, after probably another 20, 30 years, I'll just drop dead, and that'll be that. And it seems so realistic, doesn't it? And there's a sadness that envelops me, and a sense of hopelessness and inadequacy and longing. Oh God, why me? Why don't you leave me alone? I'm an imposter. It's all preposterous. You know, on and on. And it seems quite, it's such a compelling movie, right? And then we turn a corner. And of course, it's not something that this self constructs, because this self wouldn't know it if it whacked it in the head. Well, it's like whacking it in the head all of the time. But you turn the corner, and then there is a field of unimpeded brightness and goodness and boundlessness. We say a formless field of benefaction when we put on our rock suit. A formless field of benefaction indeed. And once again, we are in the garden, and the butterflies are flying about, and friends are walking slowly, and we see, and we are seen. In those moments, clearly there is no inside or outside, and it's true. It's true not as opposed to false, or true as opposed to some kind of comparison. In other words, it is not a knowledge by parable or analogy or by comparison. Comparisons, analogy, and the activity of the storehouse mind or the unconscious is completely impossible. It's not. It's no longer. There is no longer a comparison. So when we say, or we recite in the Heart Sutra, true, not false, this great bright world of this great bright world is true, not false. It is true because there isn't anything else. There is nothing but this. And there we are. And once again, we are home. And we are walking in the garden. And then once again, we loop around the stupa, and once again it becomes clear to some degree, right? To some degree, and then we again we forget, and then we are inducted into the world of thought, and the world of assumption, and the world of comparison, and the world of opinion. Anyway, it's quite a thing, isn't it? What we're engaged in, quite a thing. And it's so very accessible and so wonderfully close and given so freely in inconceivable forms and shapes. It permeates, doesn't it? It permeates the whole universe. There is, as Dayan was saying last night in his wonderful, gracious Dharma talk, it permeates everything. It's the complete solvent, the complete natural organic solvent, you know. And it's clear for a while, and then we lose track. And then this backseat driver, or this story we have about our life and the assumptions and all of those things, that comes back and starts to talk to us again and envelop us in its story. I think that one of the most wonderful and horrible things about Zen practice is that there is always, in whatever the movement of life is, there's always some innate wonderful wisdom in it, and also some incredible stickiness and problem right in the same place in our koan study or our self-study or our coming to know ourselves in deeper ways or to participate in the aliveness of the moment or to be whatever we want, however we want to talk about it, to enter into it. There's such, it's so devoted, isn't it? There is a devotion, a devotion that it manifests in a very, sometimes in a kind of misguided way, in a kind of crooked way, but underneath it is this incredible devotion. The direction's a little skewed, but the devotion is remarkably pure. It's so close, isn't it, in all of these places? It's so close. When it inducts us into it and we identify with it and look out from it, then we go looking for it, you know, outside of it. And yet right in the same hairpin turn when we're inside it, it becomes the source of well, it's our life itself, isn't it? And it is our love and understanding right there. You know, from the perspective of no inside, no outside, from the perspective of the garden, it's very clear and it's very obvious that there's only one thing happening, and everything's in drag, and everything's a manifestation. We all smell, taste, and touch that, and come and go. And it's so obvious that there's only prajna and upaya. In other words, there's only this one bright aliveness that permeates all manifestation. It always has some particular flavor, or flowering, or buzzing, or croaking, or sadness, or happiness, or something. It's so obvious that there's only this one thing. And then when we're inducted, we are that self that is looking is the self that it's looking for, as David said this morning. It's quite a thing. But it takes a great deal of stability and a great deal of heart and a great deal of devotion to enter into it without letting it induct you. Isn't that the place? We all yearn for a homecoming. I find myself longing often for myself, and a longing for my own life that I become alienated from. Strange, isn't it? I mean, here we are, as Hakon said, in the midst of water, crying in thirst, calling out in thirst, so imploringly. One of the things that we've been looking into in terms of this practice of call and response, or donkey looking in the well, or donkey questioning or inquiring, or a donkey calling out to the universe, is that we are always, I think, in many ways, David read this wonderful piece from Reb's latest book, which is quite a beautiful, inspiring, difficult book, inspiring. And the gist of it was that, and I think it's really true, that all of us as human beings are crying out, are supplicating, or calling out to the universe, and trying our best to find meaning in love, and connection in our lives, or intimacy, or truth, or love, however you want to describe it. And we all have these strategies that we employ to find happiness, or to find love, or to find connection. And the strategies of the I Am Self, the variations on the theme of greed and anger and denial, are dubious strategies to find satisfaction, but it doesn't faze us. We employ them with a great devotion anyway. But underneath, underneath the strategy of I will find happiness, and I will find love, friendship, sangha relations, and intimacy by cutting myself off in grumpiness and crabbiness and paranoia. I'll find happiness that way, because those bastards aren't trustworthy. I'm going to go back to my cabin in the mountain. That'll fix them. Or not, I'll be happy then. You know, it's a dubious strategy. It doesn't stop me from employing it again. But I think that the touching thing about koan study and self study is that in the midst of this, in the heart of this of the strategy, whatever it is, in the heart of the donkey, as a matter of fact, there's nothing but that. In the heart of the strategy is the world of release. That, you know, in the heart of the strategy is a calling out for, or a great wish to be connected, or to find happiness, or truth, or meaning, or love, or however, whatever we describe it. And a truth and a love that's not dependent upon the vagaries and the uncertainties of the I Am Self, with myself or the significant others in my life. But inside that, calling out is something that is very tender and vulnerable and immediate and alive and infinitely precious. And it's calling for itself. It's so touching, isn't it, when we look at life that way? If you look at the need or the aliveness or the vulnerability inside of the needs that we have as human beings, and they're fairly small, actually, when I think about what it is that makes me really happy and satisfied and at home and peaceful settle in myself and abide in the great infinite goodness of life. When we find our way home. Pretty simple. good meal, you know, some friends, cushion to sit on. I have my own little wrinkles that I like. I happen to like nature, so I enjoy living out in the forest in Kentucky. But more than enough, you know, more than enough, a bounty that is beyond imagination of goodness. So anyway, right there in the need of this calling out, God is, I think, is something, whatever the basic ones are, something to eat. Maybe that's what we would like, something to eat. Can't find your own mouth. It's human beings. Can't find the mouth. Put it in your ear. Bing. Gee, I can't quite find my, you know, or stick it in your eye or in your armpit. Or, I mean, you know, we have a mouth, and the mouth is wonderful and receptive, and it knows how to chew and swallow food and receive it. See, so anyway, I think that the basic needs are fairly, although the need is timeless and vast, the great heartland or the mind heart is immense, but the particular need is that it's not that mysterious. So I think one of the things we've been talking about is that we can think of our life as a calling out for to the universe. Now, as David was saying, the trick in Zazen practice is to it's not to not call. It's to, I used to hang out with Coben Chino in the old days in El Salto out in New Mexico. He used to talk a lot about this Kanandoko practice of calling and receiving, or appealing to the universe, or appealing to something that is completely beyond all understanding and conception, and how does it say, as comparison, parable, and analogy. So he used to encourage us to call out to something that's beyond your own consciousness. And then the trick was, and the calling was, not to say, you know, not to then just say, just kidding, but, you know, or, you know, when you someone throw you the ball and it's coming to you, then you turn away. The last minute, I used to, when I was a kid, I was on the Little League team in the south side of Chicago, and I was the only white face on the team, the south side, and I had a record. Some records you're proud of, some records you're not so proud of. This was a mortification record. I had the greatest number of strikeouts in history of the Little League team. 17. Oh man, talk about shame and embarrassment, right? Talk about mortification of the spirit. But anyway, I would I was so determined, as I am now, to be a good athlete or a good Zen student, you know, just, you know, I'll do it this time. And I would get up and, you know, kick the dirt off my sneakers, you know, I think I was 10. And, you know, I'd pull my pants up, you know, like Louis Aparicio, the White Sox did, and grab my crotch and, you know, and look at the picture, and I'd watch him wind up, and I would say to myself, I'm gonna really blast it out of the park this time. I'm gonna show him. And he would throw it, and I would close my eyes and swing with all my might. You know, and then I would go into my, you know, like, I'd do it this time, and swing with all my might, and it would strike out again and again. Sometimes I'd walk because he would shift his bad picture. And he'd throw these, you know, but it wasn't because of me. Anyway, back to the koan. So there is this, you know, the trick then is, I think, to appeal and then keep your eye on the ball and to open your heart to what's being offered in this moment. You know, to appeal or to ask, and then to open your heart and mind and trust, in trust that... that the Dharmakaya, the great round mirror, does nothing but respond to. That's all it can do. All it can, since it has no will, since it's completely unfabricated and has no will of its own, it can only reflect or become what comes in front of it. If nothing comes in front of it, it will reflect nothing. If If a small boy with his eyes closed, swinging with all his might and his great longing and his great heart, it will reflect that. And if he opens his eyes and appears at the ball, then there will be a touching, huh? And something will be known. Shikantaza, to touch and to be touched by something, huh? That is outside of thinking and outside of comparison and outside of, and in that touching and being touched by, a donkey looks into the well looks into the donkey, there is something that takes place that is completely unfabricated and immensely pure and clear. This synapse, huh? Right there, you know, right there, right there, right there, or in the longing for, you know, the great longing. If the longing, the koan of the longing were entered into, and there were nothing but the longing, then what would you have? That's great, great heart, wouldn't you? Great heart. What a thing. In the Rinzai tradition, I'd been, the Korean tradition, actually a mixture of Rinzai Soto. When I say that, it's non-sectarian in the deepest sense. But Rinzai Soto, it's different ways of appreciating life, you could say, the same life. But one of the things that's done a lot in the Rinzai tradition is theater. When you work with your koan, oftentimes you'll come and you will mime your experience to your teacher, like with Suzaki Roshi. A man is hanging by his teeth from a tree limb, and his hands and feet are tied. Someone comes under the tree and says, "What's the meaning of it, Alfie? Why? What are you doing up there in the tree, hanging by your teeth over this precipice?" I'm sure none of you have asked yourself this question in the course of this treatment. And when you go in and meet with Roshi, one of the things that one of the upayas or skillful means is that you become the different aspects of the koan, or you become the primary story, so you mime the story for him. You mime. See what I mean? Now, if you step into it, right, and you really mime it, and you get so, and there is no longer self-consciousness in your mind, but your activity is the activity of selflessness, of Dharma, then you enter into the presentation of someone calls to you, and you are nothing but. Now the trick is with someone that you love and admire so profoundly, as I did Suzaki Roshi, is that you're playing some big high stakes ball, and the higher the stakes, the greater the risk, and the greater the longing, and the greater the self-consciousness. So you go in and you do your mime, you know. And then I did this with him for 3 years. And I would see him 4 times a day. And I cared about this more than anything in the world. And the sucker wouldn't pass me on the koan. And I'd go, and then he'd put the stick in his mouth and go, and I'd look at him, and I'd go, and he'd look at me and he'd go, and then he'd ring his bell. I'd go back to the Zen on ice and I'd say, maybe he's just playing with me, maybe he's just screwing with me. And then I'd say, you'd have the paranoia and the doubt, and you'd think, maybe this guy is just, this is not funny. And then you say, no, I've got to try again. Go in and you'd sit in line, in the interview room, and the bell would ring, and you'd get closer and closer to your turn to go in. And it was all very formal. You do your prostrations, 3 prostrations going in, you kneel, you go through the whole, ritual. And then you do it again. And the closer you got to the soft point, the closer you got to the,
the more you close your eyes, the more you become self-conscious, and you go in and you do it, and the damn backseat driver would say, "Boy, do you look stupid. You're an idiot." And he sees you're an idiot, and that's why he's ringing the bell. Ding, ding, and I go. This went on for 3 years. This was no joke. Then I used to go back to the mountain and sit and reflect on this. And I thought, well, it's obviously just, you know, there's nothing but this. And I'd go in and I'd say, it's obvious. See, Roshi, it's nothing but this. See? That went on for a long time. But I think for our purposes, even at sea level, if you were to take the sticking place of the koan that you're working with, which is the sticking places of the heart, the ritual impasse, the ritual sticking place where you always, you know, it's there you are again, and it's invisibly got you and contracted you into whatever it is. If you were to approach it, and now I'm saying, of course, it is nothing but it, but we're talking about upaya and wisdom now, and we're trying to get close without getting, and you were to enact it to yourself or to a friend, or in front of the mirror, exactly what it is, and say, how do I do that? Or how could I enact it in such a complete and pure way that there's nothing but this in front of the mirror, or on the stage, or to my friend, or to my compatriot? You know, this is exactly how it is, right? And you were to put yourself so into it and become it so completely, and you dissolve down all separation and thought about what it was that you were doing or how you would look good and all of that, and you became, and you participated in it fully with no self-consciousness, you forgot yourself in the purity of the act itself, then you would inevitably find yourself in the world of release. And the koan would be clear. That's a Zen. That's a Shikantaza. That's all. And then we get it, right? And we all get it. Right, we all get it that it's an activity of intelligence, enormous intelligence and love, and we get it, and then we totally lose it. So how to? Maybe that's a new upaya or a way of thinking about Shikantaza, this activity of self-fulfilling samadhi, self coming to know itself through this activity, and the self only reflects what comes in front of it, and it has no. Its wisdom and love is so complete that it doesn't do anything but that. And the closer we get to that kind of participation and connection and love with whatever the aliveness is of the moment, the closer we come to this, what we call Shikantaza, touching being touched by, or this place of aliveness, which is true, not false, because there isn't anything else. Yeah. Anyway, we could talk about it. We return to our sasen in our own modest way we do our experiment.